Today we're going to talk about this war that I mentioned that's been going on for a very long time against the truth. It began before Cain killed his brother Abel. It began before Adam and Eve ignored God's instructions in the Garden of Eden. And I'm also going to break from my usual practice and give you the title right up front instead of hold it out there after a long introduction. The title for today is The Assault on Marriage and the Family of God. The Assault on Marriage and the Family of God. Now, it might seem like a harsh title to call it an assault, but I want to show you that what began with Lucifer's rebellion has everything to do with what we see going on around us today with the assault on marriage. When I moved here to Oregon in 1998, this was right after the Congress had passed the Defense of Marriage Act, and it had passed by an overwhelming majority. They called it veto-proof, which means two-thirds of the House, two-thirds of the Senate passed this, and therefore, even though the president at the time wasn't a big fan of it, he signed it because he knew that it would look better for him to sign it than for them to have to override a veto, and they were going to. So in Oregon, I remember polls listing the desire to keep marriage between a man and a woman was actually higher than the national average. So 70-plus percent of Americans thought that marriage should be between a man and a woman. And in Oregon, it was closer to 80%. And what a short amount of time has transpired in two decades to where the polls are today completely opposite. Not just in Oregon, where you may not be surprised, but all over the country. If such a law was put up for a vote, it would not pass, not even close, not even getting 50%. How did this happen? Where did this begin? What can we do about it? That's what we're going to be talking about today. You know, we live in a world that's run by what 2 Corinthians 4:4 tells us is the God of this age. This is Satan's world. He was put in charge long ago. We can read about his fall in Isaiah 14, verses 12 through 15. Gives us some background on the start of this battle. Isaiah 14, 12 through 15 says, "How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend unto heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God." So Lucifer didn't like the status quo, that even though he was in a preeminent position, the head of God's headquarters in the universe, the earth, where everything was going to happen, he was put in charge of that, the jewel of God's creation. He still was not happy with what he was given. We can see that his thought process was pretty sour. If we keep reading on to verse 13 and what God did as a result. It says in verse 13, "For you have said in your heart, I will also sit on the mount of the congregation of the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High." That was his thinking. I will be just like God. That's what he was attempting to do. He was able to persuade a third of the angels to go with him. In verse 15, it says, "Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit." Now, Ezekiel 28, which we won't read, but you can read later, tells about the story of how this being once served at the very throne of God, being his wings covered the heavenly throne. You know, this state that he is in of rebellion continues in every facet of our lives. We see it around us. A lot of times we see things that are contrary to our thinking and what God has revealed to us, and we may not think of it in the terms of this ongoing war that's happened. But as we will see, everything around us has a huge impact on this war that's going on. If you read through Daniel chapter 10, it talks about spiritual battles that are taking place, where princes of Persia and Greece are fighting with God's angels to find dominance. And this is the spiritual warfare that's going on that allows these world-ruling empires that Daniel was revealed to in a vision that we're going to rule from Babylon to Persia to Greece to Rome until Christ returns. This is all playing out, this war. We're trying to find who is going to run things, who is going to be in control, which empires are going to rise to prominence. Isaiah tells us that pride and love of self were motivating factors in Lucifer's fall. He thought so much of himself, but there's more than just that. Before mankind, the angelic realm was the pinnacle of God's creation. If you go back in time and just start to peel back the layers when there was less than there was now, before the earth was, when he created the angelic realm, what else was there? They were it. They were God's children from their perspective. And of the archangels, the chief angels, Lucifer was put out in front and was on parade because he was, in his mind, the most beautiful, the most talented, the most magnificent creation God had ever made. And he was put in charge of the earth. And we don't know how long the earth was here before the Garden of Eden was populated by Adam and Eve. We know the earth is very old. Sometime in that process, whether he learned about it early or late, that this wonderful creation, this earth, was not going to be centered around him and his leadership, but it was actually going to be a place, a proving ground for God's new children, the human race, and that these new children would be replacing his leadership in the future. This was too much for him to bear. So let's look at how Satan is assaulting marriage and the family of God. The story of man starts in Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. We'll go back and just read a few excerpts where we will kind of piece this together. Starting in verse 27. And we'll read through verse 31. So God created man in his own image. It's very important to understand that when you study the creation process, that everything was built after a kind. Even the animals, you think, well, the animals were created out of nothing. But as Adam named them, he named them after their kind. There was a model that God had fashioned all of the physical animals off after. And many of the angelic realm have attributes of those kinds that God created animals after. And so he said he created man in his own image, after his kind, after the God kind. And this was different. The angels weren't created after God's image. But then it says he created him male and female, he created them. Now, of course, in Hebrew, it's a lot harder to understand. It's kind of poetically written. Oftentimes, Hebrew is written in such a way to say, this and that together make something. You know, it's about symmetry. And Hebrew language is very, very much like that. But continuing on, it says, then God blessed them, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And he gives them all of creation so that they can just enjoy everything. And think about if you were Lucifer, now Satan, you've been put in charge of this planet, and now God tells this new upstart, you get to have dominion over the whole earth. You subdue this planet, and you make it your own. The first thing we learn is that mankind was made not after some new idea, but after God's very image, with his own abilities. Think about it. You know, animals can procreate. People can procreate. You might not think of that as amazing as it is. But think about it. Only humans and God can create sentient life. That people can think, they can create, they can build, they can do, and he said, well, animals can do some of these things, not like humans. You know, you let the animal world go undisturbed for a trillion years, and you will not find a animal someday standing on the moon, will you? You will not find an animal someday sending satellites into orbit. You will not find animals writing operas, painting works of art. It just wouldn't happen because that is not the level of intellect that animals have. But man does, because we were made after God's image. Human life is very different because God made it that way. So Satan is waging a war against humanity because as people fill the earth, he sees his dominion shrinking, his strength, his power, his prestige is limited by the fact that people follow God, not him. Now, Satan, being the god of this age, would like mankind to serve him. And we could read, which we won't today, but how Satan offered to the Son of God, to Jesus Christ in Matthew 4, an opportunity to do that very thing, that he would allow Jesus to bypass the whole dying part of crucifixion, the very bloody death, but would give him rulership over the earth underneath him, and he could bypass the plan of God. It's always been in his plan. What can he do to derail what God has created? Now think about it. Why did Satan want Adam and Eve to eat from the wrong tree? You wrap your brain around that for a minute. If they'd eaten from the tree of life, in a sense, what does that mean? They would live forever. Game over? Possibly. But maybe what Satan was doing was playing the long game. Because eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil allowed humanity to have their minds open to not necessarily what God says or what Satan says, but a whole host of other thoughts of what you might want to decide for yourself. The world is full of people that simply just want to decide for themselves what is right, what is wrong. There's this term we've talked about in the past, somebody has their own truth. Well, how can somebody have their own truth? How can you have the truth that's different than anybody else? But there are people that will say, oh yeah, that's my truth. And it's different than what you have as truth. God tells us, no, there's only one truth, and that the source of that truth is God. So he wanted them to eat from the wrong tree. Not only will they not live forever, but they will constantly come up with new ways of disobeying God. As parents, we see that in our children when they're young. They look for ways to say, I want to do it differently. You know, I'm not so excited to find out exactly how my parents want me to clean my room and to do my homework and to eat my vegetables. I kind of would like to decide for myself what I do. We call it human nature. It came as a result of eating from the wrong tree. Now, families were designed by God for the purpose of populating the whole earth because of a divine plan. It's very important that we realize that everything God does, he does for a reason. The divine plan to one day become spiritual members of God's family. Notice what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15, 1 Corinthians 15, and we'll read verses 39 through 47. First Corinthians 15, and starting in verse 39. These pages are sticking together. It says, Paul writes, "All flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of animals." Just like we were talking about earlier. Animals cannot do the things that man can do. Another for fish, another for birds. We were just talking about a woodpecker that was landing on our house yesterday, driving us crazy. It was pecking away at the metal vents on the house. You're never going to get bugs out of these metal vents, but yet they're chopping away. It almost sounds like a jackhammer. And I finally just went out there, and he looks at me like, "What?" You know, they don't call them bird brains for nothing. Just, why would you even think that that was a good thing? But they don't have the intellect that people have. He says, "There are also celestial bodies and terrestrial bodies, but the glory of the celestial is one, and the glory of the terrestrial is another." He's comparing things that we can perceive and notice. He says, "There is one glory of the sun, another of the moon, and the other glory of the stars, for one star differs from one another." So he's saying, you see all these things, they're not all the same. You can't say that they're all equal. You can't say that, why, they're all just as wonderful as the next. You can definitely see that there's a difference. He says, "So also is the resurrection of the dead." So there's a comparison. "The body is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body." There is a natural body and there is a spiritual body. So it says, "So is written, the first man became a living being, the last Adam became a life-giving spirit." Comparing Adam with Jesus Christ here. There's a difference. There was a glory difference between Adam and Jesus. There was a difference in purpose and a difference in mission. Adam came, he failed, he showed what can happen when we give in to our baser urges. Jesus came and showed what can happen if you stay the course and you follow the Father and you don't deviate from that. It shows that life was created in a hierarchy. The animals are not of the same level as humans. What do you think Satan thinks about that? That someday mankind is going to be directing angels around. Don't think he cares very much about that at all, or cares for that very much at all. You know, there are people out there that will wage war in different ways as agents of Satan. They will tell you that we shouldn't process animals for food, that we shouldn't, you know, wear furs, we shouldn't use products from animals, whether they be oils or any other kinds of tusks or anything like that, that these are not things that mankind has any right to whatsoever. That these natural resources that God said is for man to use, to subdue, and to have dominion over are not our right. And we'll even go as far as to say the world would be better off if man didn't exist, because look at the damage we have done. What God did with humanity was different than anything that he did in the angelic world. He made man limited with huge potential. And the angelic world, he gave much more power to. But then he limited their potential. It's a very different course. The angelic world was created spiritual but was limited by God because it could not have the same potential as humanity. And Satan hates that. He hates that his future will not be as bright. Even if he would have stayed the course, he knew he would never, to go from in charge of everything to now serving somebody else, this was just something that was too much for him. I do want to talk about these patterns that God uses, that he builds on earth, that he expects us to follow. Take a look at Hebrews 8. Hebrews 8, verses 1 through 5, it teaches the spiritual intent for everything physical. You know, we think, what is the purpose of mankind? It says, now this is the main point of the things that we are saying. The book of Hebrews goes and tells in detail the entire plan of God, from the physical temple that was built to the worship system and all of the things it was supposed to teach us, to what spiritually God was doing in the new covenant, and makes a very detailed study of how God took things from a physical into a spiritual purpose. And he says, this is the point of the things that we are saying. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand in the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary, and listen to this, and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord erected and not man. So everybody understood Moses built a tabernacle. He carried it around with them. And later that tabernacle was used as a model to build the temple. And there was a high priest and there was this worship system, and everybody understood this at the time Hebrews was written. But he says the true tabernacle was not built by man. It was built by God. Verses 3 and 4 talks about the priests who served the earthly version of the temple. And then in verse 5 it says, who served the copy and shadow of the heavenly things. So everything that we do here in the worship system on earth was modeled after something that God created and that has in the heavens. And it says, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacles, for he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern. What pattern? The one that's modeled after what God built in heaven. So what God makes on earth is patterned after spiritual counterparts. Many who do not know God or have any relationship with him, for their sake, they think life might not really have much of a purpose. That after this life, really what is there? They think that life is a product of random mutation and deny that we have a creator and that life is meaningless. They teach that life really has very little purpose other than what you make of it while you're alive. Ask yourself who benefits from that line of thinking. Why would Satan want men to think that way? So that they lose hope? That there's a purpose for life, that there's a reason why we're here. Why, people often wonder, why does God allow human suffering? There's a purpose. And if you miss that, if you do not understand that there is a purpose for things, you can fall into this trap of deception that life really has no purpose whatsoever. In Genesis 2, verses 21 through 24, God introduces biology and marriage to mankind. It's important here that we understand this because it leads us to something spiritual. Genesis 2, verses 21 through 24. It says, and the Lord caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and as he slept, he took one of his ribs, closed up the flesh in its place, had a physical surgery. Now, he formed Adam out of the dust of the ground. He could have formed Eve out of the dust of the same ground. But he made a physical surgery where he removed part of Adam and fashioned that into Eve. Then the rib which the Lord God had taken from him, he made into woman, and he brought her to the man. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. This is the process of procreation. Now, God made man in his own image. And then he said he made them, man and woman, in his image. So how did he do that? He used biology, separating his creation into two distinct parts, and then divided his attributes and his image between them. What does that mean? That means to get God's image, you have to put them back together. Man is not complete by himself. Woman is not complete by herself. If you take two men and put them together, you are not complete. You take two women and put them together, you're not complete. It takes a man and a woman together to become complete by the way God created them. And he wanted them to become one together. And procreation doesn't work any other way. As much as people would like to have us believe that the reproductive process is somehow separate from biology, it's not. And so we see this at war around us. Many of you remember the movie The Passion of the Christ. And in that movie, they had an actor portraying Satan. And if you remember in that movie, the way they portrayed that character was they had this actor seem to be neither male nor female, totally androgynous. And while we don't know how Satan appeared to Christ when he tempted him, it seemed fitting for the viewer to see Satan portrayed as someone who was neither male nor female, because he was never created in God's image. And so when you see this portrayal, it seems fitting that he would have nothing to do with what God had designed and ordained for human life. You know, because of the deception that caused Adam and Eve to stumble, we have within us this knowledge of good and evil for us to decide for ourselves what feels right, what seems right. And we see this all the time in the world around us. People just decide for themselves what's best. This isn't something that's new. It's been going on for a very, very long time. Let's take a look at Matthew 19. Matthew 19. This is verses 3 through 8. We see a situation where Jesus is asked about marriage by the Pharisees, hoping to cause something in him to stumble that they could use against him. Matthew 19, starting in verse 3, says, "The Pharisees also came to him, testing him, and saying to him, 'Is it lawful for man to divorce his wife for just any reason?'" Rabbi Hillel had basically said that you could divorce your wife for a whole host of reasons. And it almost got to be laughable, the reasons that you could use to say, you know what, I don't want to be married anymore. A woman, by scripture, they would say, did not have the same right to divorce her husband. Although there were methods in which a wife could go and petition a rabbi to convince her husband to give her the certificate of divorce. And so they're testing Jesus about what he's going to do about this. "And he answered and said to them, 'Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female?'" It's interesting that as an answer to divorce, Jesus goes back to the biology again, as if somehow that is super important to the question of divorce. "He made them male and female. And for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one." Again, that same biology for procreation is used to talk about divorce. "They shall become one flesh. So then, they are no longer two, but one flesh in the eyes of God." This is very important. "Therefore, what God has joined together," God created marriage, "let no one separate." Let no man separate. He's saying what God ordained to become one, this idea of taking two, putting them together and making one, and not just any two, he made very clear, male and female together, is important to God. He says, they said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and put her away? And he said to them, because Moses, of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce. In other words, you guys messed up what God created. And when you made such a mess of it, God was merciful and allowed a way out. He says, but from the beginning it was not so. Now, Jesus' strong words against divorce comes because many in the Jewish community just really didn't think it was that big a deal. They didn't realize how important it was to God that marriage represents something not on earth, but in heaven. God created marriage and used it himself. Remember, God was married to Israel. Where did divorce happen? God divorced Israel. So God is a product of divorce, just like so many people are. And yet, it was not intended to be that way. It was not supposed to be that way. Let's find out why there is something. You know, people think that attraction that we have, it's for the only reason that we have it is for pleasure. And if you can find pleasure however you do, who are we to judge you? That is the position that people take. And yet God said, all these things are for a purpose, for the two to become one. So let's read what this purpose is. In John 17, we read this on Passover. You know the scenario? Jesus is awaiting his arrest. He is praying to God to ready himself for what is about to come. A horrific evening awaited him. And yet he's praying, and notice what he prays about. Starting in verse 17, he says, sanctify them, set them apart, his people, his disciples. Sanctify them by your truth. Something you are doing goes into them. It's important. Sanctify them, set them apart. Your word is truth. And down in verse 20, he says, I do not pray for these, his disciples, alone, but for those who will believe in me through their word. In other words, us, everyone that came after them. As the church grew and spread all through the world, Jesus is praying for all believers. And he says that they all may be one as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be one in us. What is that unity, that oneness that God cares about? This marriage that we do on earth, it's the closest that we can come physically to what God has spiritually. And it takes both halves because God separated his attributes between male and female. You put them together and both of the attributes that our typical male, typical female come together, and it makes a family with all of the attributes you need to raise children, to make a bigger family. And you're so much more successful trying to raise children with two parents because they have all the attributes available to them, where if you have a single parent, it is much harder. You know, this spiritual model of the marriage of the Lamb that we are all looking forward to, the wedding supper that is prophesied ahead of us, it's a wonderful, joyous event. But think about how God does things physically so that spiritually we can learn a lesson. Why do we go through baptism? It's a physical thing. Why do we take the symbols? It's a physical thing. All these physical things have spiritual counterparts to them. Spiritual lessons that we learn, that we are reminded of them when we do them. Why did God tell ancient Israel to pick up manna 6 days a week, and on the sixth day pick up extra manna for the seventh day, and not to go out on the seventh day? It's a physical thing. He was doing them to teach them a spiritual lesson about what Sabbath is. And if they chose to do the physical lesson wrong, they were physically punished. He uses physical things to teach spiritual lessons. So he teaches us through marriage and through raising children to care about others besides just ourselves. That process of raising a family and being connected to a larger family. These are all where these concepts of love originate in the human realm. Of course, we didn't originate them. God originated them. We love because he first loved us. But this process of love through family, through marriage, and through children is this process that God wants us to experience so that we can learn and get a taste of what the unity that he has promised for us is really all about. How else are we going to know what this unity is talking about? Continuing on, it says that they may be just as we are one. So just as Jesus and the Father are one, and we know that's pretty special, notice that they may be just as we are one. That's what he is promising his disciples. He says, I in them, you in me, and that they may be perfect in one. That means the same level of unity that Jesus and the Father have. He says, Father, I desire in verse 24 that they may, they whom you also gave me may be with me where I am. What's he talking about? He's going to be getting his glory back. And he wants his followers to have that same glory that God is giving him. That they may behold my glory which you have given me, for you loved me before the foundation of the world. O righteous Father, the world has not known you, but I have known you, and these have known that you sent me. This is his last prayer for his believers before he was arrested. That what Jesus was going back to be given the glory, to be back with the Father, and to be one, as God is one, and nobody quite understands that, just on the surface, what does it mean that God is one? But yet, when you tell somebody that two people got married and they are one, you get an idea of what that means, that they are one. People have, as the tree has given them the ability, decided what roles that they want to follow. And it's not what God has ordained for them, has set out for them, has made plain is their future. And then they expect us to buy into that and to celebrate that because somehow that these are smart people and therefore they are smart enough to decide for themselves what is right. These things that we see today did not originate in the 21st century. They didn't originate in the 20th century. Let's read here from Romans chapter 1, verses 20 through 32. Paul was writing to these church in Rome, people that were living in a pretty difficult time. Emperor Claudius had expelled all the Jews. The ones that were left were sort of underground. They didn't have churches that they could meet at freely. And so he's writing to them to be bold and to come out and be honest with being Christian. What does that mean? What does that mean to transform your life? And he goes through this whole process through the book of Romans. But notice what he talks about when he starts, this is at the beginning, talking about what's going on in the world around them. And in Rome, there was a lot of human nature around us. We talked in the Bible study last night about the Hellenism and how it just indoctrinated people into the worst that Satan's world has to offer. And they definitely were surrounded and immersed with it in Rome. starting in verse 20, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead," notice, "so that they are without excuse." In other words, from the beginning, God is who he is, and mankind has known it. And man has no excuse to ignore what God is and what God has said. Verse 21, "Because although they know God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful to God, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened." It's a process that mankind goes through when he ignores God and pushes him out of his mind. His mind begins to change. "Professing to be wise," verse 22, "they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into the image made like corruptible man." Now, we talked a lot about God's image and what that means for us and what we have the capability and future and promise to do. But he says, people changed the glory of that incorruptible God, and mankind made himself over in his own image, in the image of corruptible man. What does that mean? What do you think those gods of Jupiter, of the Roman gods, the Greek gods, these gods were made after the image of man, not the image of God. These were fallible creatures that might have had wonderful powers, but they were filled with lust, greed, all of the envy, strife, all of the bad attributes that mankind has suffered with. The pantheon of gods that they worshipped had all of those. So mankind is made over this image of the corruptible man and worship that instead. Down in verse 25, "who exchanged the truth of God for the lie." And this is where it comes down to what Satan has been doing. He's been taking the truth of God, what he's doing, what he's got promised for us, inserted a lie: "You will not surely die. You can have any kind of relationship that you want. You can be whatever gender you want to be." All of these things, inserted them in, said, "Don't believe what you've been told." And worshipped and served the creature. Who's the creature? The serpent. Worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. That is the process that man's free-willed thinking has brought him to, who is blessed forever. Verse 26, "for this reason God gave them up to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature." People will tell you, it doesn't matter what people do. It's none of our business. It doesn't matter if what they're doing was, a crime in many jurisdictions for hundreds of years. Now we've gotten rid of those sin laws that were just terrible, they think. It says, "leaving the natural use of the woman burned, likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman burned in their lust for one another, men with men, committing what is shameful, and receiving in themselves the penalty of the error which was due." We see the disease that's out there, rampant in the world, and people say, "oh, well, that's not anything to worry about." "And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind." Have you seen it when you talk to people about how they have some sort of inner turmoil, even hatred at some points, for anything that is pure, that comes from the Word of God? It says, "to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceitful, evil-mindedness." Now, one of the things we don't want to ever forget is that although there's a huge pull of the flesh toward things that are immoral, they're all evil, whether it's you're killing somebody or you're abusing them, it's all evil. And it's not as though somehow people think, well, it's okay that people are out robbing banks as long as you're not this way or that way. We're not picking and choosing what God says is wrong. We're simply reading what the Bible tells us. All these things, envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, they are worshipers, are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. Sounds like anything you've seen in the news lately? Knowing that the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. So what do they tell you? It's not enough that you tolerate certain behavior. You have to become an advocate. And if you don't become an advocate, then you are a hater. And that's just what you are. You're evil. You're terrible. Because you don't promote that which the Bible says is wrong. Who would ever inspire that kind of thinking? The God of this world. So in the time that we have left, what do you do about it? How do you stand up against it? Do you just run out there and start picketing, condemning people when you see things that are not right, when you see things that are wrong around you? What is the approach that we should be taking? There are people who will try to convince you that there's only two courses. You accept them or you're against them. So what is the course that we should be taking? Now, Jesus said, first of all, that his servants would not fight to prevent him from being arrested. Why? Because his kingdom was not from here. This is not the battleground that God is trying to win the fight. This age, as we understand this, is going to come to a close. That God is going to allow life to almost be extinguished so that his son can come and save mankind from a fate worse than death. The extinction of all life. That is God's plan. So we're not going to find a way to save this age. So where is our battle? What should we be doing? You know the story when Jesus was preaching in the temple. He was teaching. Don't know if he was teaching children, adults, but he was teaching. And the Pharisees brought in this woman who was accused of adultery and wanted to use this opportunity in a very public place with all of these witnesses to pin him to the wall. Either you're going to condemn her to death or you're going to break the law of Moses. One of the two, you're going to do something and we're going to get you. And we all know the story about him writing in the dirt. We don't have to go through and read all that. And finally, they all leave. And then he says to him, has no one condemned you to the woman? Jesus says to her after they're all gone. And she said, no one, Lord. And Jesus said to her, neither do I condemn you. That's the part where they wanted her put to death. Neither do I condemn you. But he says, go and sin no more. So does he become an advocate for her behavior? No. Does he admit that what she did was okay? No. In fact, he tells her, stop this behavior. But I'm not here to condemn you. That's important. That's a very important lesson. Ephesians 4, we're told to come into the unity of the Spirit. In verse 15, we are told to speak truth in love. This is also very important. How do you speak truth in love? And how do you do this? Well, first of all, it means not accepting a lie for the truth. But can you do that without condemning somebody? Yes. Because think about the examples we have of some very bad people in our Bible. And there's quite a few. You know, when John the Baptist was arrested for talking to Herod Antipas about his illegal marriage. He was arrested, he was put in jail, and eventually killed. Now, if that was the behavior that God wanted everyone to follow, Christ himself might have followed that same example. But we know for a fact that Jesus took steps when John was arrested not to have the same fate, not to be arrested, not to go and condemn Herod so that his ministry would have ended just like John the Baptist. It could be that John willingly accepted this fate because he said right before he was arrested, "My ministry is done. His ministry is just beginning." So we could follow the example of John the Baptist, or we could follow the example of Christ who says, "I've got work to do. I'm going somewhere else. I'm not going to go condemn Herod. I'm going to continue on with my work." Remember when Paul was arrested and he was in house arrest in Caesarea? There was a period of time when King Herod Agrippa, different Herod, came to visit him. And what Luke records in the book of Acts is that King Agrippa and Bernice came to see Paul. They had this conversation. And at the end, he said, "Wow, if you hadn't appealed to Caesar, I would have set you free." They had a very good meeting. They all left feeling great. But yet, there's no record that Paul condemned Herod Agrippa. Why would he condemn Herod Agrippa? Because he was with Bernice, who was his sister. And Josephus talks about, yeah, everybody knew that they were an incestuous relationship. Paul didn't bring that out. Probably he wouldn't have been given the green light at that point by Herod Agrippa that everything is great, you should be freed, if he had said you should not be having this incestuous relationship with your sister. Later, Paul would appeal to Rome, to Caesar, who was Nero. It's kind of hard to not notice some of Nero's faults. Nero was a pretty bad guy. And yet, history seems to record that Paul won that appeal. He appealed to Caesar and he was let out of prison for a time. Probably did not condemn Nero either. When the Apostle John talked about the beast, he talked about the number 666, but he did it in code. Now, why did John talk about the beast power in code? Because speaking about the beast power in person and in name would have ended his ministry. It would have ended things. He would have been thrown to the lions, burned to the stake, however so many of them were killed, and John had work to do. So I guess you can choose to do what John the Baptist did if you feel your work is ended and you're ready to be done, or you can approach it the way Paul did and said, "I became all things to all people that I might win some over to Christ." So if somebody asks you the truth, you can't tell them a lie. You got to give them the truth. But you don't have to condemn people either. You don't have to go and find people that are sinning and say, "I need to tell you that you're sinning." Because that's not the example that we're given in Scripture. Paul was going to people who were being pulled, led by God, by God's Spirit. And he was trying to win them over to Christ. He was not going to people in the marketplace and saying, "Oh, I see that you are a bad person. I need to straighten you out." You think, well, is that denying the Spirit? Is that denying what God tells us by not pointing out every fault of every person we see? There just simply is not an example from Scripture where people went around looking for people with faults and then bringing them to their attention. Because if you did that and you became a very difficult person to be around, is basically what you would become. Jesus likens himself to a good shepherd and says, if you want to be safe, stay within the herd. Peter says Satan is like a roaring lion who is out on the outskirts of the flock trying to find those that separate themselves. And we can. We can separate ourselves. We can pull ourselves away from the main body, and we are more vulnerable to Satan's attacks. So he says, stay together. The unity of the Spirit, that unity that marriage pictures, that family picture, that all is going to be part of God's wonderful family, that's where our focus should be. And of course, if somebody asks you for the truth, you give them the truth. You don't hide your light. Putting your light on the hill is not the same as shining a light in somebody's face. It's two different things. So we need to keep ourselves undefiled by the world. And what did Paul go to jail for? What was his crime? Preaching the gospel. Not condemning somebody for their behavior. He was preaching the gospel. Keeping ourselves undefiled and preaching the gospel is doing God's work. If you enter into the battle for Satan's kingdom and try to fix what's here that's broken, you're not going to win because this world is not savable. It only exposes yourself to assault. So let's stay close to the truth of God and to one another, and let's speak truth in love and not condemnation.